I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the prescription drugs that as many as 15% of Canadians are on, and the extreme and rarely discussed side effects that they can sometimes cause.
I woke up one morning and instantly knew something has gone terribly wrong. Something's wrong with my body, and I quickly realized I'd lost all sexual sensation in my body, and there was like a dulling of tactile sensation in my genital region, and it's just never gone away.
Wait for that. The woman you just heard is named Emily Gray. She's been living with a condition known as PSSD for 6 years now. Emily is a co-founder of an NGO that deals with this issue. It's called PSSD Canada. PSSD stands for post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. And as Emily said in our opening clip, PSSD can lead to the effective erasure of a person's sexual sensation and functioning. The SSRIs that seem to be at the heart of this condition are selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, a group of antidepressant drugs that have been around for decades. The latest numbers indicate that nearly 20% of Canadian women and 10% of Canadian men are on these drugs. And it is generally known that there are side effects, and a loss of libido is a pretty common one when you're on these drugs. But what we're talking about today, and what advocates like Emily have been saying for years, is that the side effects can be very extreme, and they might persist even after you stop taking SSRIs. That would be the post part of PSSD, post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. Emily is going to join us today to talk about her experience. We'll also be speaking with Dr. David Healy, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Cardiff in Wales. Dr. Healy has been involved in SSRI research for decades. He's the author of over a dozen books on psychopharmacology, including Let Them Eat Prozac, The Unhealthy Relationship Between the Pharmaceutical Industry and Depression. Also on our panel is Dr. Caroline Pakal, a psychology professor at Queen's University, whose research focuses on sexual well-being and includes sexual psychophysiology. And one thing that I've got to note before we get into today's show is that when it comes to matters of science, especially medical science, things that have to do with public health, your health, we understand that a podcast is not where contentious issues get settled. A lot of listeners say that we should just let science speak, but science is often inconclusive. Science is often contrasting and conflicting voices trying to figure out what is true. The way to reach what is true is not by having a debate on a podcast. Today, you're going to hear some expert commentary about these medications. These are not the only experts out there. But what these experts have to say, and what Emily has to say about what's happened to her own body, all of this, we think, is worth listening to. Wait for it. I'm going to ask you each just to briefly introduce yourself. Tell me where you are and who you are, beginning with you, Emily.
My name's Emily Gray. I'm from Vancouver Island, and I am a 6 year now sufferer of PSSD. I advocate and try and raise my voice about the condition and try to empower others to do the same.
Yes, I'm David Healy. I've been working in the psychiatric field for over 40 years or so. Before the SSRIs came on the market, I did a PhD on the serotonin system, which left me well placed to get a feel for the issues linked to this group of drugs.
Hi, my name is Caroline Pakal. I'm a professor of psychology at Queen's University in Kingston. I'm also a Canada Research Chair in Sexual Health, and a lot of my work exists at sort of the intersections of patient symptoms that are distressing yet grossly misunderstood by the field of research as well as the medical profession.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us, Jesse.
Thanks for having us.
Emily, if we could start with you, can you talk about PSSD? What is it?
Absolutely. So PSSD stands for post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. It is essentially a medical injury that can develop in people during or upon withdrawal of an SSRI drug. People also experience the same symptom set sometimes from SNRIs and from tricyclic antidepressants. And there's a wide range of severity within the symptom set, but the core symptom is a reduction or removal of sexual function and sexuality in general that persists long after the drug has been taken. So you might stop your treatment and then there will be a withdrawal period, but if it persists longer than 3 months, then it can be classified as PSSD. But it can go on in some people for months, it can go on for years, it can be indefinite. I'm at the 6-year mark. I took my last dose of citalopram in March 6 years ago when I was 23 years old, and I'm almost 30 now, and I have a complete elimination of my sexuality that began very suddenly during the withdrawal of citalopram, which is an SSRI. This is a common story within the PSSD community, and people experience devastating relationship breakdown, a really wide range of impacts on their lives. It has a huge impact on self-esteem, general quality of life. And you also have emotional blunting and quite frequently cognitive symptoms that appear alongside the core sexual symptoms.
I'm so sorry. And I'm grateful to you for talking with me about this. I imagine that some people who suffer from this are reluctant to talk about it publicly.
Yeah, and that's a huge, huge part of why this has gone underrecognized for so long, because it is just not something that people typically bring up, even in a confidential clinical setting. So I've talked to people, quite a lot of them, who maybe will attempt tentatively to bring it up with their doctor, but then they receive a little bit of, you know, something that they feel is dismissive, or the doctor will just say, oh no, SSRIs can't cause that, and then they'll retreat and they won't bring it up again. And it only takes one experience like that for people to just shut down and not want to talk about it at all, because it takes so much for them to bring it up in the first place. And that's in a confidential doctor-to-patient setting. You know, this is not something that people are talking about around the water cooler. So this is very underreported. There's just not even close to enough public awareness, and that's part of the reason that it's flown under the radar this long.
And how long were you on SSRIs before you stopped, and now you're 6 years off of them and still having this loss of sexual function? How long were you on the medication?
So I was prescribed an SSRI, citalopram, when I was 17 years old, and then I was on it at a relatively low dose throughout the next 4 years, not 100% consistently. Sometimes I would try to taper off it, but it was always just low-dose citalopram. It wasn't polypharmacy for me. It was just that one drug. And then over time, I began to notice it impacting my intimate relationships more and more, and I decided to taper off at the age of 22. And then I was tapering throughout the period of my 23rd birthday. And so at 23, during this taper process, I woke up one morning and instantly knew something has gone terribly wrong. I've lost something. Something's wrong with my body. And I quickly realized I'd lost all sensation, all sexual sensation in my body. And there was like a dulling of tactile sensation in my genital region. And it's just never gone away.
I think that there's like a general awareness that there can be sexual side effects with this medication. I once had a psychiatrist say to me, you know, people know from the ads and whatnot that like sexual side effects can occur. You might have some loss of libido. Let me tell you something. They probably will occur in my experience. But I think that the people who know that think of it as something that happens while you're on the medication. What you're telling me that 6 years after you have lost sensation and even emotional effects like of romantic feeling, that is new information to me. Dr. Pukal, to the question of how common, is there anything known about how many people experience this?
A general population study showed that it was about 4% of 100,000 people was the rate, which points to it being quite rare indeed. However, I believe it is more common than that tiny little number. Working in this area, interacting with a lot of patients who have this. I'm also a clinical psychologist, and so I certainly do support and help treat individuals with PSSD in as much as a psychologist can. And so I would argue that, you know, it is not as rare as one might think, but the numbers I'm giving you are just simply estimates, but they're not accurate as far as the research goes.
Even, you know, subjective terms like rare or relatively rare, to Dr. Healy's point, when you're talking about medication that is used as widespread as this is, rare is still a whole hell of a lot of people. I have here in front of me that 20% of Canadian women and 10% of Canadian men are on these drugs. So 4% of those, we're going to test my math here, but thousands and tens, hundreds of thousands of people. It's shocking to me because when people are suffering depression or anxiety and you're told, here's a drug that can really work wonders for you, it can really have life-changing effects, and you may have sexual side effects. If you're suffering every day, obviously a lot of people will take that gamble. If you were to tell people, I know you're experiencing depression or anxiety, we have something that might help with that. However, you may lose all sexual function for the rest of your life and have numb genitals and not be able to experience love. I think that your buy-in would be a lot lower.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's almost the opposite of what you said. You know, the first thing you said, which is you will have sexual side effects. You may get a benefit.
This episode is brought to you by Article. Listen, we take our patio season seriously here in this country of ours, and we should. This is our time in the sun, people. But is your patio furniture meeting the moment? Article is a Canadian furniture company, and they have great stuff for inside your home or office. But not everybody realizes just how great their outdoor furniture is. I have a patio set from Article, and frankly, it's kind of nicer than our living room. I love this stuff. The Article furniture on our patio is high quality, well-crafted. It looks great season after season. If you need to upgrade your patio game, check out article.com/CanadaLand. They ship directly to you. I think you'll be surprised at just how stylish their outdoor furniture is given the price point. Really competitive given the quality of the stuff that Article makes. You can also take advantage of this great deal. They're offering listeners of CanadaLand $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim this, visit article.com/CanadaLand. The discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/CanadaLand for $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp, and BetterHelp are focusing right now on workplace stress. I'm here with Noor. Noor, you've like settled into like regular hosting. How's your stress?
Yeah, I'm pretty stressed, but trying to manage. You know how it is.
I do. I think it's just something that comes along with caring about what you do, mm-hmm. which is not to say that it's not something you got to monitor, you got to stay on top of it, and it's not something that you're just going to turn off. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's not the right goal, is like, I leave that at work. Personally speaking, it's about a practice of knowing that this stuff kind of lingers with you, knowing that anxiety and stress, and sometimes, you know, kind of like manic elation, if you're excited, all of it like follows you outside of the newsroom, and having somebody to talk about it with helps a lot. I like telling our listeners about BetterHelp because BetterHelp is the largest online therapy provider, which means that they're better than anyone at just connecting people with mental health professionals, mm-hmm. which is a big part of the process, is just how many people don't get help because they just don't know where to start, or they find it daunting. You want a therapist that gets you and that you're going to click with. And if it's not, you can switch therapists. I think that's a really big feature. Like I said, BetterHelp is the largest online therapy provider in the world. They can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. So talk it out with BetterHelp. Listeners of CanadaLand get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. I want to be very, very careful as a layperson, as a broadcaster who is not a scientist here. There is a lot of controversy around these drugs. They are widely used, probably some of the most prevalent medications out there, but there are people who are passionately against them for a number of reasons. Everyone from Scientologists who have taken aim at psychiatry to naturopaths. There's a huge anti-pharmaceutical sentiment out there, which is justified in many cases, but it has led to a widespread suspicion. I don't want to give people bad medical information on this show, especially when my understanding is that all of these complications notwithstanding, SSRIs are miracle drugs that save lives. What is the balance that we want to reach here? Because the three of you are appearing on this not a science program, but a program for kind of the general interest listener, to raise some pretty alarming red flags that would certainly give me pause before considering this medication. Do either of the doctors present here feel that these drugs are appropriate in some cases, or am I talking to two doctors who are like anti-SSRI doctors?
Let me talk first here, because I'm able to actually give the drugs to people, okay? And I don't want these drugs removed from the market. They can be helpful. They're not miracle drugs. If you're severely depressed, I would use one of the older antidepressants, not an SSRI, because they're not particularly helpful for people who are very severely depressed. They roughly help perhaps about half the people that get put on them, and they don't help the other half. It's a bit like an LSD trip. You can have people who do well on the drug and people who do poorly. In terms of being able to treat people, they're just one of the different kinds of antidepressants we have, and it's good to have them because there are people who will be helped by them, but it's terribly important to remember that there are people who aren't going to be helped. At the first hint that they don't suit you, we need to change to a different drug, or consider the possibility that, well, you're going to get well without these drugs anyway. It may take a few weeks, it may take a few months, but I'm happy to keep meeting with you to keep an eye on things and ensure that they work out the right way.
And Dr. Pukal?
I also agree with Dr. Healy. I think they are absolutely an option to prescribe for individuals. As a psychologist, I do not prescribe medications myself. I do find that doing an assessment, a very careful assessment of a person's severity, of their history of depression, coming up with appropriate diagnosis, that is actually key in terms of informing the kind of treatment that a patient will get. This may involve particular kinds of antidepressants. It may involve therapy. It may involve a combination of the two. What I am finding is that people present to their family doctors or to a physician at a clinic, and they say that they've been feeling a bit low, a little bit down. There's no careful assessment. There's no really looking at a person's function, looking at having a discussion around the different options that are there. I find that a lot of SSRIs are being used as first-line treatment, and prescriptions are just handed out to patients without careful assessment, without careful follow-up, without careful conversations about the potential side effects, without even referral to non-pharmacological options such as psychotherapy that has been proven by science to work for depression symptoms. So I find that there's a lot of carelessness when it comes to prescribing these medications, and that there's not a lot of informed consent around that process. And there's also not a shared narrative that we have in society to be able to tolerate feelings of sadness or feeling low. It's almost like you're not supposed to have them. You need a fix for that. But it is part of a range of our human emotions. And it is only usually a problem if it's associated with a lot of distress, a lot of dysfunction in terms of being able to go to work, in terms of being able to get out of bed. And so I find that conversations around depression do not really account for sort of regular sort of ranges of expression. Everything seems to be pathologized to a certain extent. So I do believe medications serve a purpose, but I do believe they need to be used very carefully. I think that careful assessments need to be done. And I think that very specific conversations about the risks of any medications also need to be had.
Yes, can I bring us back quickly to a point Emily made, which is it's not just about informed consent. I mean, if you get told there can be problems, people will often say, oh, yes, I'm happy to go ahead and have the pills anyway. But as Emily brought out, one of the problems that PSSD highlights is the fact that you go back to your doctor after you have a problem and you get faced with doctors saying, well, we just don't believe you. You must be depressed. Let's increase the dose of your pills. So it's not just informed consent, it's the response of doctors after you have a problem. Very few of them are able to entertain the possibility that they've really harmed you and try and work with you to see if there are ways to try and put this right.
Emily, has that happened to you?
It has, and it hasn't been every doctor. There have been some who have been responsive and wanting to learn more and to listen, but there's a lot of just ignorance about the condition because it is understudied and underreported. So yes, there absolutely are some who just, they don't want to hear it. It goes against their worldview. There are others who are very interested in learning more and who are caring, but they can't do anything for you because they just don't have anything that they can offer you.
And because loss of libido is, my understanding is that when you're feeling down, if you are depressed, you might be less interested in sex. That might be hard to distinguish from an after effect of the drug.
Like, that can be true in some cases. Some cases of PSSD are reducible to a reduction in libido, but we're talking about for often years at a time. And other cases of PSSD are far more severe than that, as in a total loss of sexual sensation entirely, as in your genitals feel like your elbow. It can come with erectile dysfunction for men. It can come with, you know, lack of lubrication for women. And also there's these cognitive and emotional symptoms, which often appear at the same time. And for me, this was a very rapid switch. I literally went to bed feeling normal, or at least what my baseline was during the taper. And then I woke up in the morning with this symptom set that has never gone away. So, you know, there's no evidence that depression can cause a symptom set like that.
Can I ask our doctors about that? Because that just sounds horrifying. But they also sound like two different things. To lose sensation physically feels like, and again, I'm asking this as a layperson trying to get my head around this, a neurological problem. If I just couldn't feel something in a very sensitive part of my body, I would think that there's something, some nerve damage. But to not be able to experience certain emotions, in my kind of like taxonomy of where things come from, that feels like it's coming from a separate part of my biology than a loss of physical sensation. What do you understand about why this is happening? Please explain this to me as if I am a slow child, because I sort of am when it comes to these things.
You said that, look, loss of libido, that's the kind of thing that can happen when you're depressed anyway. But people who are depressed don't say to you that I can take a hard bristled brush and rub it up and down my genitals and feel nothing.
I've never heard a depressed person say that. That's true.
No. So once you hear that, you kind of realize that this is not a mood disorder. This is something else. It's, as you said, a neuropathy of some sort. Now, what the SSRI group of drugs do is they act on the sensory receptor system. Whether you think the problems in the brain are in the peripheral nerves around the body feeding into the brain isn't clear at this point, but that's roughly where the problem lies. At the moment, we don't think the damage is permanent, in that some people do recover or have windows where they improve a bit. So, you know, if we could get people researching this, there's hope that we can work out what's going on and put it right. And the big tragedy here isn't just that people aren't able to talk about it or get laughed at when they talk about it. It's the fact that no one's doing any research on what's going on here in order to try and put things right.
That's helpful. And that's from our medical doctor present, and from Dr. Pukal, our psychologist. Is that compatible with your understanding of this? Are there different theories at play? Because I take it that this is not a terribly well understood thing.
It's not well understood at all. Theories are pretty limited in terms of action specifically, but I certainly do agree with Dr. Healy in that there is some kind of neuropathy that is involved in the development and the maintenance of these symptoms.
Emily, you're speaking about very intimate things, and I think doing so bravely in the hopes that it'll help other people and perhaps yourself if people care more about this. I will take that as an invitation to ask you more questions, but if anything I ask you is too personal or too intimate, please.
Ask away, it's okay.
Has anything helped?
Short answer, no. Initially, I had pretty severe cognitive symptoms that accompanied it, and those have dissipated to a substantial degree. So initially, I was having like constant memory problems and sleep issues as well. And that seems to have faded over the 6 years I've had it, but the sexual symptoms are still 100% there. So I've been left completely asexual and sexually dysfunctional because of this round of medications.
Emily, you mentioned that you were put on this medication. Was it in your teens?
I was 17, yes.
Emily, what made you decide at the age of 17 to go on this medication? How badly were you suffering when you went on this medication in the first place?
I mean, I had had pretty persistently low mood for a couple of years at that point. Throughout the year that I was 16, I had had an eating disorder where I'd been restricting food fairly severely. And though that had cleared up through like talk interventions to a large extent. By the time I was put on the drug, I was still experiencing a lot of negative emotions around myself and my body. But like in retrospect, a lot of that was not atypical for an adolescent girl. Like Carolyn and David Healy have both pointed out, SSRIs are frontline treatment. Like they're offered quite early on. It wasn't presented as the only option, but it was presented as a very safe option to try. And that if they made me feel better, then I could take them. If it didn't work, then I could just come off them. And it wasn't presented as something that could have long-range consequences. So I went on them. I did feel a sense of stabilization. And then right after that, like I was off to university, ended up being on them for 4 years pretty consistently. But in retrospect, there was no good reason for me to be on them for 4 years like that. And I would never advise my own child in that same position to look at a pharmaceutical option for something like that. Again, I'm not anti-medication. I'm pro-informed consent. But the conversations about how people come to view these medications as both necessary and safe needs to be part of that consent process.
I'm aware that a lot of children are given these drugs.
Adolescence is a time when a lot of people end up being prescribed an SSRI, and some people are even younger. You know, some people are kids when they are put on these medications. It definitely raises issues around informed consent because, as both Professor Pakal and Professor Healy were saying, an adult can weigh up the risks and say, is this risk worth it to me to try this treatment? A child who does not have a sexual baseline because they haven't had a chance to develop one yet cannot consent to having their sexuality permanently stunted. I personally know people who were put on these in early adolescence. The specific person I'm thinking of started SSRIs when she was 11, and then slowly as she grew up throughout her teens, realized that she didn't have a normal sexual response. And it took her a long time to remember back, think what could have caused this. She's never had an orgasm in her life. So it's impossible to know what her sexual baseline would have been otherwise. But the fact that we know that these drugs can permanently remove someone's sexual function and that they're being prescribed to people who are still in the thick of their mental development is quite disturbing, and it raises serious ethical questions.
Emily, I'm imagining that your reason for speaking out about this is, well, why don't I ask you, because I can see a lot of benefit for people to destigmatize it just so people can get support from each other. But are you hopeful for a cure?
I mean, that's a huge question mark. It really depends on if we're able to get the research into what actually causes it. It's probably going to be a really long road. I have no idea. I don't have an answer to whether or not there's going to be a cure to this. I can certainly speak to the profound effects on a person's life. You know, when you think about the role sex actually plays in our lives in terms of just feeling like yourself, feeling like it's part of your identity. And also people find partnerships and build families through their sexual relationship. Like your marital relationship or your long-term partnership is a core aspect of most people's lives. And if your ability to do that has been gutted, a lot of people just feel a great deal of despair about their future. Sexual disfigurement and the attendant shame that can come with that is something that strikes at the core of who you are, and it eats away at you. So will there be a cure? The short answer is simply, I don't know. I can't give you an answer to that. I also know people in the wider community who have taken their lives due to this condition, and it's heartbreaking, and I get it.
I have to ask Dr. Pakal and Dr. Healy, given that these are some of the most widely prescribed medications in existence, I suspect that we're going to be flooded with email after publishing this from people who feel very strongly otherwise. Are you outliers? Are these sort of rebel opinions in the medical community that don't reflect the wider consensus? Dr. Pakal?
I'm not an outlier per se. Like my world of research is in sexual symptoms that are not well understood. This can be pain. It could be arousal in the body. It could be PSSD symptoms. What I'm doing is I've launched some research in this area along with Emily and another PSSD sufferer, as well as a team of researchers. We are trying to understand, it's not pathophysiological in nature, but we're trying to understand lived experiences of PSSD in order to then inform individuals, medical professionals, the lay public about this condition so that people are aware of it at the levels of perhaps being an SSRI user and being more informed about choice in treatment, or being a healthcare provider and having better conversations and follow-up with patients on SSRIs. This is well within my wheelhouse in terms of sort of my research approach, where I don't go in with sort of strong messages saying that SSRIs are evil all the time, but to open up conversations and to provide information and scaffolds for individuals as well as healthcare providers to make decisions that work well in their lives and in conjunction with other people, to have more of a collaborative approach to this, as opposed to saying, don't prescribe them. Pharmaceuticals are terrible. I say, you know, they are an option, but we need to care. And we need all parties involved in this decision to have information that they don't currently have. So I can tell you, in the sexual medicine community, I have presented on PSSD a few times, some of the research we've done, as well as kind of more overviews. There has been a lot of interest, and there has been a lot of questions about how can we best serve people in sort of that discussion around SSRI use and prescriptions and doing more careful assessments for depression and anxiety, etc. And so I think, though, that when you go against structures and you go against professions that, you know, sort of hold a lot of power, pharma companies hold a lot of power, psychiatrists, doctors hold a lot of power, sometimes you are sort of going against, you know, sort of the current. But I always say persist, provide good data, work with people who have lived experience, and continue to educate people. And if, let's say, the doctors are not, you know, necessarily open to this idea, then what we could work on are the patients themselves in terms of having better conversations, switching doctors, trying non-SSRI medications, and coming to their doctors with their concerns. So we need to work on multiple prongs of, you know, sort of groups of people in order to make this work for most people who are going through sort of very concerning mood disorders, right? So that's where I stand. That was a long-winded sort of response, but it is very complex in my world anyways. It's not an easy black or white thing for me.
And you, Dr. Healy, are you an apostate at the American Psychiatric Association conference?
Not remotely, no. Not an outlier at all. I've actually been a consultant and run clinical trials for most of the major pharmaceutical companies. So, you know, I'm anything but an outlier. My insights of what's going on come because I've had close links with the pharmaceutical companies, where people who are in kind of positions of power have talked openly about what they know the drugs can do. They can cause people to become suicidal. They can cause PSSD. But like the tobacco companies and lung cancer, you don't expect the companies producing tobacco to do the research on lung cancer, because that means they have to admit legal liability for the problems. So the pharmaceutical industry are aware of all this, but they can't be seen to do the research. They can't be seen to say, yes, we know that the problem was there. We've known it was there for a long time, and we're going to try and find the answer. Unlike tobacco, doctors make a living out of these drugs. So they haven't been quick to jump in and find the answers. Unlike doctors when faced with lung cancer, who were the people who did the research and pinned down the link between people actually smoking and getting lung cancer. Let me give you one quick story, which I think brings home how we should view these drugs. SSRIs can be helpful. But as I told you, the man who created them, a man called Arvid Carlson, said, yes, they can help some people, but not all people. And if you go on SSRIs when they don't help you, he said, look, these drugs can make you suicidal. Some of his patients who were put on SSRIs said to him, look, your SSRIs don't suit us. When we go back smoking, we feel a lot better. So he did a clinical trial comparing people who didn't respond to SSRIs to people who then went on nicotine, and found that for that group of people, the patients were right. Nicotine was much better for them, helping the mood and helping them feel less anxious. Now, the moral of the story is, we all know nicotine comes with risks and that you need to know what you're doing if you're going to opt to take it. You need to at least be sure that it's helping you, that you feel more relaxed of it, that your mood's better if you're going to take these risks. We should be viewing all the drugs we use, SSRIs and nicotine, etc., in much the same way. These things can be poisonous, and the art of medicine is to bring good out of the use of these tricky, dangerous kind of substances, which can do good, provided you and your doctor are working closely together.
Thank you so much, all three of you, for talking with me today.
Thank you, Jesse, for listening to us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Jesse, good to talk.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. I can be emailed about what you heard today at jesse@canadaland.com. I read all the email I receive there. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Caleb Thompson does the audio production and editing for this show, and this episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Canada Land's director of audio is Max Collins. I am our editor and publisher. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I'm Noor Azriyeh, and today we're talking about the news. We'll talk about poor Alberta's $8 billion surplus. We'll talk about Canada's labor trafficking problem. But mostly, we'll be investigating a Polyev-shaped hole in the Canadian media landscape.
Pierre Polyev, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to see you, Sean. It's been a little while.
We have so much to talk about.
Wait for that. On the pod today, we've got national politics reporter from Canada's National Observer, Arno Kopetsky. Welcome.
Hello, Noor.
Not one, but two defeats for Pierre Polyev.
Lost the election and lost his seat.
I think it was a big strategic error.
He's adamant he's staying on as Conservative leader.
Pierre Polyev will face a leadership review early next year.
It will be an honor to continue to fight for you and to be a champion of your cause as we go forward.
Feels like I'm ready to shed a tear here.
Yeah.
This has been the question swirling in op-eds and columns, and definitely the question swirling around in my group chat with Sam and Aviva, who work with me on the politics show on Tuesday. Has he disappeared? Is he plotting a comeback? Is he licking his wounds? Where is Pierre? Arno, do you find your mind having these Pierre Polyev thoughts the way I do?
It's a little intrusive. I wish I could just forget him about him entirely, but he's still there, Noor.
He's lingering.
Is indeed plotting. But it is a little less requited than it was for the last 2 years.
Let me read some of these headlines. You know, for some columnists like Dan Lett from the Winnipeg Free Press, Polyev is limping. Here's the headline. Polyev limps away from spectacular campaign crash.
Make your browser fast.
Gets hit by fact-filled EV. This article, by the way, like, I would never want Dan Lett to write a op-ed about me because it...
Nobody does. You never want an op-ed written about you.
No, please. Because this article focused on Pierre Polyev's recent attack ad against the Liberals' electric vehicle policies.
Well, somebody wants to tell you where to go and how to get there. It's the Liberal government's new attempt to ban your gas-powered vehicle. Starting next year, they plan to bring in what's called a zero-emissions vehicle mandate that becomes more and more stringent until it bans gas-powered vehicles altogether.
The campaign's called Pull the Plug, but Dan Lent couldn't even get to the point of the article, which is the EV attack ads, before absolutely roasting the out of Pierre Poilievre. For weeks now, political reporters have been trying to figure out which version of Pierre Poilievre is going to rise from the political ashes. You know, there's a Toronto Star opinion exchange between Susan Delacourt and Matt Gurney, which is basically like a what happened to Pierre roundtable. Matt pops the big question, and he literally calls it that, like, is he safe? Is Pierre Poilievre safe? The article ends with a line from Susan, which is, Poilievre may be able to save himself, but it's going to require a reversal of where he is right now, the disappearing conservative leader. Max Fawcett, your colleague at the National Observer, is jumping on this too. Surprise, surprise, knowing Max, I was waiting for this very piece. Pierre Poilievre might be cooked by Max Fawcett and the CNO. 10 points for the Gen Z lingo. I see you. There's a Globe and Mail article. Can Pierre Poilievre outrun the yesterday's man label?
Konrad Jakubowski.
Exactly. It feels like there's a huge Poilievre dunking contest going on here.
Well, yes, I think there is indeed. I will just note that people were saying all of these exact same things about the Liberal Party for the last 2 years, up until everything flipped entirely upside down and they took it away. So let's keep that in mind before we pronounce the death and the end of Poilievre's political career. But absolutely, things are looking dark for him right now. I love that analogy of him like limping out of a train wreck and only to get hit by another car as it drives by or whatever. You know, it's just one thing after another for the guy. He didn't just lose the election. He lost his own seat and he's locked out of the House of Commons. You know, he's never been further from the spotlight in his entire political career, I think, spanning back decades. I followed his campaign around the country in April. The National Observer sent me around to do that. So I went to about 15 of his rallies from Halifax to Vancouver Island and in between, multiple press conferences. The vibe at those rallies was pretty crazy for a Canadian political movement. It was rambunctious, thousands of people everywhere, small towns, big cities. And one of the fixtures of every one of these rallies were the right-wing conservative influencers or content creators.
Hello, hello. Whoa. Oh, thank you, thank you. Hi, 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 hi. Hi, hi, hi. Look at this lineup. Oh my God, it's keep on going. And it's an hour and a half before the event starts.
You'd see them, they've got their iPhones at the end of these polls and they're walking through the crowds and they've all got hundreds of thousands of followers, which I could only dream of. And they're walking through the crowd and people are asking for selfies with them. And so these influencers are themselves as popular almost as Poilievre was. And, you know, they all, like Poilievre, sort of rode a wave of enthusiasm out of the Freedom Convoy. A lot of these guys, and women, but mostly men, these influencers became politically activated during the Freedom Convoy and then started up their YouTube channels and just got these huge followings. And they've been super supportive of Poilievre.
Are they rising from the ashes as Pierre Poilievre is?
Poilievre has just disappeared from their feeds ever since the election. It's not just one or two of them, but universally, I looked at all of their, well, not all, but like as many as I could track down, you know, over a dozen of these folks. And they're still fighting the culture wars. They still are all in on conservatives. They're sharing speeches from conservative MPs in the House approvingly and selling all the same messages of anti-vax and anti-Palestine and climate change denial and all of those things. But the one thing that is glaringly absent from their feeds is any mention of Pierre Poilievre whatsoever.
Huh. It's interesting because, sure, he's disappeared from the spotlight, but he's not really doing anything differently. You know, he's still doing sit-down interviews. He sat down with Sean Spear from The Hub.
Pierre Poilievre, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to see you, Sean.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
We have so much to talk about. I'm really
It's like a 40-minute interview. The man's got his own podcast.
Hi, everyone. Pierre Poilievre, leader of Canada's Conservatives. As part of my series to introduce you to the growing and even more impressive Conservative caucus, I introduce to you Chief Billy Morin.
He's out there. He's doing press. And yeah, you talked about this a little bit. His appearances outside the House of Commons have made him look to really distanced and less connected with his party and his MPs. And he frankly looks a little bit lonely and sad out there.
He does.
back to work at caucus today after the most recent election. We didn't come out on top.
But you're right that I haven't been seeing him on my social media the way that I had been for a long time. I'm on TikTok a lot, maybe too much, and I should seek help. But I also get a lot of these like Canadian politics TikToks, and it's just like conservative MP roasts liberal minister in the House of Commons. Like I get a lot of those,
yeah.
And I used to get a lot of Pierre Poilievre in the House of Commons and like digging at the liberals and making a fool out of Justin Trudeau.
The high school drama teacher over here accuses others of liking the sounds of their own voices. This from a guy who, if he were made of chocolate, he would eat himself.
I'm not seeing that anymore. I'm seeing lots of videos of Andrew Scheer.
If photo ops and phony rhetoric actually got things done in this country, then Justin Trudeau would still be prime minister.
Melissa Lantzman.
A hat trick for the prime minister, but not the good type. Three reports released in just one day paint a...
And you're right that there has been this, like, social media drop-off of him, even conservative influencers that I had followed. Why do you think this is happening?
One thing I think it sort of reveals is sort of the groupthink of us, both us journalists and I think some of those influencers, that we tend to move as packs, and suddenly everyone has just sort of, without saying so, decided to ignore Pierre Poilievre after having spent 2 years just drenching him with press attention, you know, and he just got so much of it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that switched. So there's a thing about the fickle nature of media coverage. You know, Mark Bury wrote this pretty great, I thought, biography of Poilievre called Ripper. And in that, he described Poilievre as somebody who really hasn't changed in his entire political career. And he had this great line about it when Pierre Poilievre became so incredibly popular and rose to the top, both of the party and national polls, that it wasn't Poilievre who had changed. He was doing the same thing he'd been doing for 20 years. It was the country that changed and came to him. That really influenced the way that I thought about Poilievre and the country and sort of the political climate. And I think the country has changed once again, in large part because of Trump, of course, and all that that has sort of illuminated for us about our priorities and where we want to go and where we don't want to go. So here he is now, still not changing.
Arno, we like to duly note stories on this show so they don't get overlooked. Do you have something you want to duly note?
I sure do, Noor. One thing that I would like to duly note is Alberta's roaring oil and gas industry. Contrary to all the complaints one hears from the Premier of Alberta, that Ottawa is choking oil production and refusing to let the province flourish in the way that God meant it to, Alberta just posted an $8 billion surplus, largely based on the fact that Alberta is producing and exporting more oil and gas than ever before in its history, including to Tidewater, thanks to the pipeline that Ottawa bought and built from Alberta to Vancouver, where I live. Alberta is killing it. They're doing great. They're doing so well. They're getting everything a person could ask for. And I don't know how that doesn't precede every single media comment on Danielle Smith's complaints about how Alberta is suffering under the yoke of a tyrannical Ottawa. They are getting everything they want. They're flourishing. Things are going great.
Danielle Smith, you hear that?
You listening?
Duly noted. Arno, I want to duly note a story, this also an immigration story. I'm on an immigration wave, maybe because I'm an immigrant and I pay attention to these things, but there's a recent story by CTV News written by Danton Unger, hotel owners in Manitoba charged in labor trafficking investigation. So essentially, two women working at a hotel in Manitoba came forward to the police with allegations of labor trafficking, and then two other alleged victims came forward as well. These four victims were all from India and were recruited to come to Canada with a promise of a labor market impact assessment, which is an LMIA agreement. These agreements help you in your permanent residency application. And this LMIA would also legalize their work in the country, but only one of them actually was granted the LMIA. All four were allegedly forced to work 15-hour days, 7 days a week. They were being paid less than half of minimum wage, and they were also allegedly threatened with deportation and intimidation tactics. One of the victims, allegedly their identification documents were being withheld, and I'm assuming that's things like a passport and a permit and things like that. To be clear, none of these charges have been proven in courts and any court, and they're now a matter of the courts. But this story is just one of so many. And I've just been noticing this kind of like rise of vilifying immigrants, and especially immigrants from South Asia. All of these victims were from India, and I think there's been so much hateful rhetoric that I see on social media these days. You know, there was even a report published by the Institute for Strategic Dialogue that found that there was a sharp rise in online hate targeting the South Asian community in Canada, specifically on X. And personally, I have been seeing it, these kind of rampant, hateful comments about South Asian immigrants, people who are trying to come here for a better life in general. And I think that conversations about immigration in this country have been reignited. There is a newfound focus on how many people are we letting in? Who are we letting in? Where are they from? What can they provide us? Immigration is talked about as this like super transactional process, and being an immigrant and seeing how those conversations are playing out, it's really interesting to me how there are some folks who immigrate here who are not vilified in the same way as those from South Asia. That being me, I am a good immigrant in a lot of people's eyes, and too many others. There are some good and there are some bad immigrants, and I just think that the conversation is getting really worrisome, and I want to continue to talk about the fact that these people are also victims. They are not trying to like play the game and dupe the immigration system, and I think that we should be focusing on what is the root cause of all of the issues that we're seeing, and I think it's not people. It's not individuals. I just want to keep talking about immigration because if the government's talking about it, we should.
Silence is violence. I couldn't agree more, nor we got to dig into the better angels of our nature and proceed with humanity for all of these people, these humans who are coming here and trying to make a better life, just like most of us or our parents did.
Exactly.
And, we're all, you know, with the exception of First Nations and Indigenous folks, you know, the vast majority of Canadians are immigrants. And it's so important to remember that. Duly noted.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it at noor@canadaland.com. I read everything you send, the good, bad, the ugly. You can find me posting on Blue Sky at noorazriya.bluesky.whatever comes after that. Arno, where can people find you?
You can read my stories at the National Observer, and also I write a monthly column for the Walrus magazine. And if they want to reach out to me personally and tell me how much they love or hate what I've most recently written.
Don't encourage.
It's a sign of success when people reach out to you, no matter what. I'm on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Instagram at Arno Kopetsky.
This episode was produced by James Nicholson. The associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier, who also did the fact-checking. Mixing and mastering is by Tristan Capicchione. Our director of audio is Max Collins. And the editor and publisher of Canada Land is Jesse Brown. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
precision of a puncturist between my iron shoulder blades.
panuwarado sa wagbago.